It's 2020, and in the US, this is shaping up to be an incredibly interesting year with the election coming up in November. So we're taking the opportunity to actually glance over the ocean back home to the home countries, into Austria, Switzerland, as well as Germany, and let you know how we do this back home in the motherland. This is the podcast of the Germanic American Institute.
Welcome.
Willkommen.
We're Germanic-speaking European countries.
Germany. Deutschland.
Austria,
Österreich,
Switzerland,
Schweiz.
Blend with the Midwestern United States.
Hallo.
Servus.
Grüezi.
We are here and there, and we invite you to come along on the journey. You know, it's quite interesting to observe this as we are living in the U.S. and knowing a little bit about the U.S. election system and who we actually have to choose from. And then looking at what we're doing back home in Central Europe, and the differences couldn't be, I would say, more pronounced. And to help us to understand this today, we do have, once again, the two leading ladies of the GEI in the room with me. We have Claudia.
Guten Tag.
And we have Katrin.
Moin.
Moin. But you know what? We'll flip it around this time. It's not about the main topic first. First, we'll talk grammar, just to get it out of the way, because Katrin is super excited to talk about the most important mistakes that we make in German.
I think that this is the most important topic in this podcast. So let's get started.
You win.
I would like to talk about a couple tidbits today and not have one big topic, but a couple of smaller ones, things that always stick out during language instruction time and when one as a German native speaker speaks with non-native speakers. The first one I would like to talk about is the use of beide and und. So in English, you can use both and, or you are supposed to use it. Both Goethe and Schiller were good writers, for example. In German, that doesn't work. Shortly, beide plus und is always, always wrong. And most of the time, the use of beide actually does not work. So for example, a sentence that wouldn't be correct, but that I hear a lot is, ich habe beide Goethe und Schiller gelesen. You would only say, ich habe Goethe und Schiller gelesen. You wouldn't say beide in there. Or beide, Jekyll und Hyde, kenne ich sehr gut. Well, Jekyll und Hyde kenne ich sehr gut. Not beide. Beide just leave out most of the time. We can either translate both as sowohl als auch, either or, and we accentuate both nouns with that. Ich habe sowohl Goethe als auch Schiller gelesen. Or we could just use und, which I did above a little bit. Jack und Jill sind gestern hier angekommen. The short takeaway, don't use both and in the same sentence.
In which instances do you then use beide? So how would you use beide correctly?
Beide you can use as an article or as a pronoun. So for example, beide Blumen gefallen mir sehr gut. Both flowers, I enjoy both flowers.
Or what if somebody gives you the two options to begin with, right? What if somebody says, hast du Goethe und Schiller gelesen? Then you can respond and say, ja, ich habe beide gelesen.
Mm-hmm, exactly, right? And that is the second way. That's a pronoun then. We can use it as a pronoun.
Yep.
Okay, so as soon as we have, let's say, Goethe und Schiller back in the sentence structure, we would not use beide.
With an und.
So, ich habe beide, Goethe und Schiller gelesen, wouldn't work.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's English or Denglish, really.
Yeah. Right. Okay, interesting. Because colloquially, I've heard it before, but grammatically, obviously, we have a little bit of cleanup to do that.
It's probably somebody that, you know, spoke English well. The second tidbit I would like to talk about is warum and the use in English and German. So in English, you can totally say, that's why something happened or didn't happen. You cannot say that in German. So das ist, warum ich habe dich gefragt. That's why I had asked you. Can't say that. Or das ist, warum ich glaube dir nicht. That's why really means deshalb, aus diesem Grund, deswegen, darum. And the proper word, the proper expression would be, das ist, warum ich dir nicht glaube. So warum kicks the conjugated verb to the end, which we have a lot in German, that these verbs get kicked to the end, common pattern.
When you look at the class offerings that we have from start one all the way up into the B levels, at which point at which point would you emphasize such granularity? Right at the get-go, or is that further on down the road? When would you expect something like this to come up?
I mean, we talk about word order in a sentence from the start, really. Right. And then once you talk about conjunctions, that's when you throw that in there. That a lot of conjunctions kick the verb to the end. And the way we are teaching, we go step by step, conjunction by conjunction. And at some point, warum enters the picture, and then it's taught that it does what it does.
So that would be about G300, right around there-ish.
Possibly.
A2 level.
Because I think I have that coming up here within the next couple of weeks in one of my classes. It's a G300 class. And I saw conjunctions in the near future. So that would make sense. So just for those who are wondering, what time frame would it take you essentially to get from start one, so from the very beginning levels to G300, what would be an appropriate time for
a
non-speaker?
A
yeah, about 18 months. Mm-hmm. So definitely it's a little bit of a journey, but it's good to know in advance as to what not to do, I would say.
Well, and it emphasizes the part where you can't translate word for word because certain expressions or certain things are just unique to each language. And people will certainly understand what you're saying, even if you're using these structures. But that's what differentiates then the level of knowledge and the nuance in the language. As Katrin says, you know, some of these words, you know, conjunctions get added and maybe warum comes at a much later level. But
in German and English, as closely related as they are, you know, coming out of one language, really, they do have different language systems. I mean, in German we have cases, in English we don't really have that anymore. It's done with prepositions. So language learning at all times means that you have to have a certain tolerance for ambiguity.
Ambiguity.
I can never say it. Meaning we cannot translate everything one-to-one, and we cannot explain everything totally either. Some things are just the way they are.
Right.
Which is, of course, the worst answer to give. It's like, why is such and such in such and such ways? Like, well, that's just because it is. And it's, of course, not the best answer, but sometimes really that is the most applicable answer.
And it builds character and patience.
Character through language adversity. There you go.
But I think this is kind of a nice segue for our next topic, right? Similarities and differences in the way we vote. And how,
very smooth.
Right?
Yeah.
Quite a few similarities, as we'll find out, but there are also some significant differences.
Let's start with the big umbrella differences. In terms of availability of parties and how we actually vote, since Germany is, of course, one of the largest countries, and it is the Germanic American Institute. Let's start with Germany and look at the political landscape there. What does it look like? How is voting being done? And how does it all play out?
So in Germany, every person that has the right to vote, and that means generally 18, although for some local elections it can be 16 as well, you have two votes, and one is the vote where you vote for a party, and the other one is the vote where you vote for your candidate directly. So you could vote, for example, in your own precinct or area for somebody that belongs to one party for a name, but then you could vote with your second vote for a party that has nothing to do with the party that, you know, your preferred candidate is from. In the end, that is the reason why the parliament never has the same amount of people in it. They switch with every period. And right now we have the largest parliament that we've ever had because they need to adjust if, you know, a party gets, I don't know, 5%, and that doesn't match the number of candidates that was directly voted into the parliament. So it's some very advanced math, at least for me, that they then figure out how many seats there actually are.
I think overall Germany has 600 or 598, but currently I think there's over 700 delegates as part of these Überhangsmandat.
Yeah, which currently also leads to the problem that there aren't enough seats.
Yeah. like physical seats.
Actual physical chairs.
Correct.
Interesting. Yeah. Austria, in contrast, for instance, has 183 seats. So a much smaller number. How many times or how often do Germans actually vote? How many years apart? In the US, it's commonly 4 years, right? As far as I understand.
Yes.
Yeah, well, but House of Representatives, I think, is two. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And senators are, what, four or six? Mm-hmm.
Oh, six.
Six.
Yep. So, and I'm actually looking up how it works in Switzerland, right? Since that's the third country in our Germanic part. Sorry, we really don't have knowledge about how voting in Liechtenstein works or in some other German-speaking countries. But yeah, in Switzerland, there's 246 seats, 200 in what they call the Nationalrat, which is their larger assembly, and 46 in the Ständerat. So they also have, seem to have a fixed number of seats. And they also have that dual system where you have a vote for a party as well as a vote for a candidate. And that is, I think, the single biggest difference to the system here in the U.S., in the U.S. where all your votes are directly for candidates. There are no party votes. And I think that is the other big difference between the systems in Europe and here in the U.S. All the countries in Europe seem to have a multi-party system, right? How many parties are part of the government, the different governments in Germany, Katrin?
Of the different state governments? Mm-hmm. Seven, I think.
Right.
Currently. And oh, maybe even eight, because the one in the north always have guaranteed seats for the Danish minority party.
Okay.
So we're at eight parties.
Yeah, in Austria we are, I would just call them sort of the larger and leading parties, if you will, who have a significant number of members or significant enough to make them a large party. And also, of course, adjusted for a country that's on the whole accounts for 8.9 million people. So, of course, the numbers are fundamentally different than American numbers. But the primary parties are essentially nine parties, from the Social Democrats to the Volkspartei, so the Party of the People, the Freedom Party, the Green Party, the Neoliberals, Communists, Liste Fritz Trinkhauser, so that's a private list essentially that was put together and led by an individual. Team Kärnten, which represents the southernmost state in Austria, and then the Alliance for Austria. So that's just the main parties, the leading parties. And underneath that, on a more regional, perhaps local level, depending on where you are and how you look at it, you have at least another, and I'm just scrolling down the list, another 30 to 35 choices. So there's a lot of momentum. There are a lot of candidates, particularly for the regions, if you will, with regional issues where regional representatives are being elected to see certain things through that make absolutely no sense on a federal level. And with that being said, there is just a lot going on a ballot. And you really have to stay informed. It's not just, quote unquote, as easy as black and white, go left or go right. This comes in all kinds of colors with all kinds of ideas. And to really make a choice that is informed as a voter, you've got to stay on top of it.
Yeah, and I see the same thing here for Switzerland, even though Switzerland is a rather small country. It does have four languages that are being spoken, mm-hmm. and very different mindset if you take a look at larger cities that are more, you know, maybe in the northern tier with Zurich, Bern, Basel, which are much more industrialized. And then you get into the smaller cantone, so state in Switzerland is called a canton, which are very mountainous and then bordering Italy and France. So I can only imagine how the regional differences play out in the government and the formation of government and in the parties in Switzerland as well. So where not only do you have very different regional interests, you also have very different languages that are being spoken. And even though German is, I think, the language of government in Switzerland.
I believe so, yeah.
But I think so is French and so is Italian. So I think there are very significant differences in the majority interests and how some of the bigger cities, Zurich, for example, is a very large city, and then you have some very small alpine villages, how that's balanced.
I think noteworthy, too, is that full women's right to vote was only achieved in 1990.
In Switzerland,
with a decision by the Supreme Court, or a constitutional decision. Up until it was the last canton or state that did not have women's voting
right
rights.
Vote. Yep.
And, you know, that's not that long ago.
No, that was barely 30 years ago. So that was, and that's the other thing, too. They explained that, voting is a matter of the... of the cantone. So it's a federalistic and a föderalistische Schweiz. So each state has the authority to set these regulations. And to Katrin's point, Appenzell, and I think there were some other smaller cantone in mountainous cantone in the mountains where, women's right to vote came very, very late.
We touched on this earlier, or Katrin, you touched on this earlier, that in certain states you can vote at the age of 16.
For local elections, for Kommunalwahlen.
Like mayor and
Stadtrat.
City council and those kinds of things. Yep.
That was about the same until 2006, where it varied depending on the election, whether it was regional or federal. And in 2006, it changed. Now, every Austrian citizen at the age of 16 is eligible to vote.
For everything,
it appears. And that obviously has taken place after I left. So quite interesting to see that I would say a lot more responsibility is placed upon the next generation to stay informed and to essentially have a voice in the process of voting. Which also gets to say, for instance, the Austrian president, which is a term of 6 years, is truly voted upon by the public. So the majority vote rules. You have to have an absolute majority to become president. And if it's a tie or within a certain margin, then the vote is repeated until somebody essentially comes out to be the victor.
So that's not a party vote. That's a person vote.
Correct.
Okay. And it has to be a real majority. It can't be a combination.
So, I would just call it perhaps direct democracy, if you
direct
will, that
vote,
direct vote that applies to that. Obviously, a little bit different here in the U.S. And it's a term of 6 years. But at the same time, and I think the same rules apply to Germany to some degree, the president doesn't necessarily have an executive function in the sense that the president makes decisions. It's more a representative function. And then the chancellor essentially is running the show, which is the same in Austria.
Right. In Germany, obviously, everybody hears about Angela Merkel. She's the chancellor and she's the head of government.
It's a rep. No, I think the head of government is the president.
It's the president.
But it's a representative office. So they have very little formal power and they can, how do you call that? Decline to sign certain laws.
Right.
But I think in the history of in the history of Germany, that has happened twice. And one time was not that long ago, but I don't remember what it was about.
Same situation in Austria. And we did have a little bit of a falling apart. I think it was last year or the year before, perhaps, with Sebastian Kurz, who is the chancellor of Austria, the youngest chancellor ever to be essentially promoted or elected into such office. And quite, let's just call it, progressive policies from a youth standpoint, but certainly did not come without critique from neighboring countries, thinking that Austria is sliding a little bit more and more to the right again, which, based on history, has, of course, some concerns throughout particularly Central Europe. Of course, it's not exactly true, but it's in the heat of the moment and news reporting and social media an accusation that is very quickly crafted. The Austrian government essentially fell apart, so it was revoted, and Kurz once again ended up as the chancellor, now forming a new government with new parties. And now essentially we have a color combination, and as we usually go about this, If it were red and black, then we have a coalition and we call this a certain color. And at this point, I think we're working on the color turquoise. So there is red and green is now functioning together in a variety of ways, trying to somehow hash out how this is going to work. And then you have all the other parties, the seven remaining parties, also having a word in this.
So I think we need to explain that for people who are listening here in the US. So in Germany, it's the same thing. And parties tend to be associated with the color. So the Socialist Party tends to be associated with red. The Green Party, obviously, with green. The Christian Democrats are black. The middle party, the FDP, is yellow. So they're associated with colors. And then when these elections happen, no one party tends to have enough votes to have a majority rule on their own. So they need to always partner with some of the other parties in order to form a government. Because in order to have a government, you should have a ruling majority so you can get things passed. And since no one party tends to have enough of the votes on their own, they need to do these different color combinations. And, you know, in Germany, some things were thrown around with different colors and how these coalitions work, and you know, different rainbow colors.
It definitely makes for a collaborative environment.
It has worked pretty well here since the post-war, but with the continuing individualization of society, we are really facing some problems now, because it used to be that the two large parties, the socialists and the conservatives, were the largest, and then they each had their partners that they would pick for coalitions. But that is on the decline now, and they have all of a sudden now shares that are much smaller, while some party on the right really is rising, and also the Green Party has added a lot of votes to themselves. And we have this law in Germany that any party that wants to be member of parliament has to have at least 5% of the vote. We learned from the Weimar Republic when that was not the case, and coalition changed, you know, on a daily basis with parties that had maybe one or two seats in the parliament. However, as society is changing, the role of the parties is changing, and especially the two old large ones are currently very much trying to figure out their role and what their tasks can be now.
And they are consistently losing share. And yeah, as Katrin says, some of these larger parties traditionally had in 30, 40 plus percent of the vote, and then they just needed one of the smaller parties to partner with them to form a government. Now there's often a discussion between three or four parties in order to gain that ruling 50% in order to form a government. And that makes it much, much harder. And that means you have to move much, much further away from your founding principles on what your party was based on. So compromise is good, but if you compromise to the point that everybody has to move away from their party principles, then that opens the door for some of these stronger, newer parties that, you know, that are really fundamentalist or populist parties, which, you know, we see here in the US too. And it's an interesting development, but that's kind of the downside of the multi-party system here in the US. You really only have two parties to choose from, which isn't always great either, but having too many has another set of problems.
Are we going to Turing?
Sure, we can talk about Turing.
Please cut this out, obviously. Are we going there?
In American news media, I think it is not necessarily the narrative, but it has been portrayed at times that Austria and Germany is sliding a little bit more towards what is being considered the right. Some call it extreme or alt-right. For obvious reasons, that's a concern. Is this true from your perspective, being tapped into the political scene a little bit more from a German perspective, or is this something that is just really making for good news headlines and sells advertising?
I mean, we have seen all over Western society this shift to the right. As people feel they're losing their liveliness or livelihood, and as people feel things are really, really changing and anxiety creeps in. And yes, these parties on the right are definitely on the rise in Germany, certainly. In Germany, so far, we have had the fortune that it's really not been okay to openly vote for these parties. That is unfortunately changing slowly. And just last week in Thuringia, we had the example where the governor was voted in with the votes of the extreme right wing, or some even say fascist fraction, of the parliament. The gentleman at the time didn't think there was anything wrong with that, but at the same time, apparently there are enough people in Germany that think that that's an absolute no-go, so the backlash was immense. Mm-hmm. He announced he was going to resign the next day, and then 2 days later he actually did resign. So yes, we have the shift or the strengthening of the right. However, it has also led to a political awakening for many people that have been very passive in the past, you know, 30, 40 years, because everything just kind of went okay. And, you know, there wasn't that much of a difference between the two major parties. And now it is different, with these parties really having some very extreme and, yeah, questionable, definitely not democratic values that they're propagating.
Yeah, and I think the interesting part is that at the same time, and we briefly mentioned it, is that the Green Party has really gained significant following as well. So it's not just that it's sliding to the right, or these, you know, populist parties or whatever you want to call them, but the Green Party has gained much, much strength. So it's not that people are just moving to the right. People are moving away from the large traditional parties.
They're moving away from the center.
Yep. And that's because they feel disenfranchised by that, and they feel that that system is no longer working. And then they kind of align with what more closely fits their situation and their viewpoints. And it doesn't necessarily have to be right. If that doesn't fit for somebody, then they also move a lot further to the left. So, right, it's interesting. But yeah, that far right party, the AfD, is now part of the federal government and in many mm-hmm. of the state governments in Germany, because they reached that 5% mark.
They're in the parliament, but they're not part of the federal government.
Right.
Yeah. And we've had these waves in Germany before, right? Yeah. In the 60s, we had the, you know, I don't know, fascists or something becoming very strong. Then in the 80s, we had the German Republicans, that are also a right-wing extremist party. They disappeared again. So this is kind of the third wave. We'll see where we go.
Yeah, while you are explaining the situation in Germany, I've been trying to look up a news article that I actually read in the morning. It's an Austrian newspaper, and it has since disappeared. Nonetheless, it did make it into the headlines that somebody had a SS tattoo on his finger, and so obviously visually present, and he was placed under arrest and then essentially tried and found guilty for what's called Wiederbetätigung, so reenactment, if you will.
Yeah, in Germany, that's considered hate speech, yeah. And you're not allowed to do that.
So yeah. We are taking anything that goes back towards that time of history, I would say, incredibly serious, and we act on it. So and that's a little bit of a gripe that I have, I suppose, with American news media, is to lump it all together. And just because there is a political expression through a party system doesn't really qualify, if you will, to immediately lump it together and say, oh, they are turning back into what used to be Hitler Germany or Hitler Austria, that there are legal safeguards and legal protections, if you will. There's an environment that does not permit that. And if it were to come to that, then something of dramatic significance would have to happen to push us in that direction. So just when news articles are being published in the U.S., it's more really about making sure that the headline sticks, as opposed to really truly representing what's going on, at least from my perspective.
Right, I agree. And no, I think, you know, we also need to talk about some of the things that are similar. So we now talked about the multi-party system, which is very different, and then how votes are put for parties, and that's how the number of representatives for each party in the ruling government is determined. But there are some similarities. And for example, Switzerland has a system similar to the U.S. Senate here, where each canton gets the same number of representatives in one of the chambers. So that's the kind of equalizer, right? Where you have a system where, just like here in the Senate, where each state gets two senators, and in order to make changes or to pass laws, both houses of the government have to agree, and that is very similar to in Switzerland to the U.S. system, and Germany has a similar system as well, right?
Mm-hmm, they do. Yeah, the each state has, I think, 4 right votes in the Bundesrat, no matter what the population size is. Or the
yeah, it's pretty similar in Austria, actually. Can I throw you a curveball?
No.
Absolutely. Here it comes. From your perspective, being clued into politics, how do you perceive Brexit affecting Germany or Central Europe or the European Union as a whole?
Brexit, in my opinion, is another expression of this shift to the right in parts of the society. If we look at who voted pro-Brexit, it was not the young, hip, well-educated. And I think there is a lot of discussion in Britain still about whether this was the right step to take or not. And we'll see now how Britain really fares, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to have less impact on Germany and on Central Europe and the European Union than it will have on the
exactly
UK.
The other way. Yeah,
I agree with that as well. To me, it feels like a little bit of this hurry up and wait kind of situation. It was finally pushed through and finally acted upon as of January 31st, I believe, was the date of the official exit from the European Union. And I do believe, and at least that's the way I interpret the news, if you will, that everybody's now sort of in this, well, let's see what happens there, if this was really a smart move. And
yeah, and there's just a lot of confusion, I think, all around. Well, like, do we need visas now to enter the United Kingdom, you know? Or how does this all work? I have several friends who actually became German citizens. Now, they've lived in Germany for a long time, but they're British-born. Because they didn't know what their legal status was going to be.
Right. And I mean, the UK was never part of the monetary union. So they never adopted the euro to begin with. And so they've always been separate money-wise.
Monetarily. Yeah.
Yep. So I think, but yeah, they're going to have to negotiate a lot of trade agreements, right? Whereas before that was part of the package as part of the European Union, which was everything treated as kind of like one marketplace. And I do believe they have to the end of the year, this calendar year, to negotiate all these trade agreements and contracts. So, and that's where I think the let's wait and see attitude comes from, to see how these deals can be negotiated. But yeah, everything is now open to negotiation. The US, I know, is going to talk about a new trade agreement with the UK, and we'll see how that works out for the UK.
Interesting times, for sure. It's kind of good to live that from the outside and not being directly involved in it, to be honest with you.
Well, we got our own interesting times here in the US.
Isn't that the truth? We'll see how 2020 falls in place.
Yeah.
Of course, if you do have any questions regarding our systems, there are numerous resources out there. If you want to ask us a particular question about the systems that we haven't answered, or where we were not detailed or too ambiguous, just please shoot them our way. We are happy to answer questions. And last but not least, as with every single episode, we do have events coming up, and I faithfully hand it over to Claudia because I can't read.
No, obviously, you know, away from the heavy political topics. But yeah, we thought it was an important topic to cover, since there is a lot of political discourse going on right now, especially here in the U.S. and a lot of things moving in Germany, but and Austria and Switzerland as well. But as always, we have a bunch of fun programs and events coming up, and starting at the end of February, we have another film that we're showing in Kino Kneipe. The film is called Westen, and it's set in the late 70s during the Cold War. And it talks about a woman who lives in East Germany. And so she escapes from behind the Berlin Wall with her son and leaving memories behind to start a new life in the West. And we're still kind of talking about this topic East-West, because while the wall fell in November of 1989, the country didn't actually become unified until the following October. Mm-hmm. So there was a period of 10-11 months while the reunification happened. So this is kind of still something where we're talking about the whole East-West thing. So come join us for Kino Kneipe for the film Westen on Saturday, February 29th. If you're interested in learning German, but you're not quite sure what to expect, join us for a Schnupperkurs, Intro to German with Kaffee and Kuchen. So it's an Intro to German with a traditional Sunday afternoon coffee and cake, Sunday, March 15th. You're going to learn a few German words and phrases, learn about our language classes here, and on top of it all, you're going to get some great homemade, home-baked German Kuchen. So Schnupperkurs, Intro to German, Sunday, March 15th. For those of you who are interested or want to learn more about German citizenship or dual citizenship, come to the Kaffeestube talk on Saturday, March 28th. The Honorary Consul Barbara Müller from the Federal Republic of Germany is going to give a talk about what it takes to be a citizen in Germany. And it's a breakfast and Kaffeestube talk combination on Saturday, March 28th. And more information is available on our website. And then to celebrate the coming of spring, we have a new festival on our calendar. It's the Salvator Fest, and it is Salvator is a beer from Paulana that was brewed by monks and consumed during Lent when there were restrictions for what monks were able to eat. So this was something that had a large content and nutritional value. So it's an old beer and a new GI festival. So we're partnering with our beer partner Paulana for this festival on Saturday, March 21st.
So basically it's bread in a bottle.
Bread in a bottle, liquid bread, absolutely. And that's kind of how we're positioning it. There's going to be a bunch of fun. It's an indoor-outdoor type thing with, you know, fire pits outside and the bars are open inside, so it should be a fun event. It's the first time we're doing this here, so March 21st for that. So as always, all of our programs and events you can look up on our website gai-mn.org, and if you have any questions or comments or feedback, please send us a note at language@gai-mn.org. But that's all I have for the upcoming programs and events.
I think that's a pretty full calendar as usual. I think this was one of the heavier episodes.
Yes.
for sure.
Tough topic.
Yeah. With that, we will say goodbye. Catherine, thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Cheers.
And Claudia, thank you very much. Yeah. Heavy, heavy episode, heavy topic, and for the most part, there are no right answers when it comes to, I guess, making selections. They are personally informed. With that, I will sign off as well. We will hear you at the next episodes, and we are working on some individual guests and individual interviews. Stay tuned for more information on that. Until then, Michael signing off. Tschüss.